and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm Holly Rubinstein. I'm a travel journalist and editor. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. Today, I'm joined by the travel writer and broadcaster, Simon Calder. He's TV's travel guru and the travel editor at the Independent newspaper, where he's known as the man who pays his way because he doesn't accept any freebies from the travel trade. And in this episode, he gives some great tips for traveling on a budget. I spoke to Simon at the beautiful Kensington Hotel in London. He's got such a great story because his first job was at Gatwick Airport, cleaning planes and working on security. And the notion of simply traveling abroad while working there felt like a distant dream. Now, of course, he spends his life traveling the world. Make sure you stay tuned for his all-time favourites and hidden gems. There are some really interesting ones in there. As ever, all the destinations mentioned by Simon are included in this episode's show notes. So let's hear from him now. Simon Calder, welcome to the Travel Diaries. Thank you so much for being here. How are you?
Well, all good. It's never been a better time to be a traveller, and I think I can pretty much say that that's been true all through my life. It's just been better and better.
I mean, I can't imagine how many places that we could potentially cover when it comes to your travel diaries, but I'm looking forward to discovering some of them. So let's start then with chapter one, and that is your earliest childhood travel memory. What would that be?
Well, I was born beside the A23 in Crawley, which is about 2 miles south of Gatwick Airport, a place which was going to figure quite largely in my life later on.
Yeah.
Halfway between London and Brighton. And Crawley, for anybody who kind of knows it as it was in the 1960s, not a particularly exciting place to be. So going abroad was the most exciting. Sorry, going abroad, chances of doing that were extremely remote. Going anywhere, which wasn't Crawley, was really quite exciting. So the first family holiday trip I remember was to Swanage in Dorset. Beautiful place. It was before they decimated the railways, so therefore you could catch a steam train from London Waterloo.
Oh, how romantic.
It was so exciting. We stayed in the Grand Hotel, which was, of course, quite grand when I was five. I went back there recently and it didn't look quite so grand. But even better and far more vivid was the following year when I was six. A couple of things happened. First of all, the my parents dispatched me and my very slightly older sister for a week with the Woodcraft folk going to the Lake District.
What are the Woodcraft folk?
The Woodcraft folk are a kind of very right on combination of scouts and guides, brownies and cubs, and very left wing. And so it was all kind of tied in with the Communist Party, with the cooperative society and stuff. And basically, the idea was that you would go off and explore and grow as individuals. And they were very casual because, of course, you know, having a six-year-old, and I think my sister was seven, was a slightly... Well, they were different times. That was great. And then also later that year, it was the Cuba Missile Crisis. And for anybody who's under 50, let me just remind you what happened. The world came closer to nuclear Armageddon than it ever had done because the Russians were moving, the Soviet Union, forgive me, were moving missiles into Cuba. And it looked as though the Americans were going to launch intercontinental ballistic missiles in the general direction of the Soviet Union, which would have been annoying because then they would have fired some back, which probably would have been aimed a few of them at Gatwick. So therefore, we would have been obliterated. So my parents said, where can we afford to go to? And the furthest they could afford to go to was Guernsey in the Channel Islands, which required getting on a plane, which was quite the most exciting experience of my entire life at that point, possibly my entire life now.
Wow. So the Cuba Missile Crisis could have instigated your love of travel, essentially.
Yeah, well, I think being born in Crawley instigated my love of being anywhere apart from Crawley, which inevitably involved travelling.
And what was your impression of Guernsey, having, you know, not left until then?
My main memory was, of course, of flying in a Vickers Viscount from Gatwick Airport and just racing down the runway, and off we went, and landing in this beautiful island. And I remember my father was having to work, but my mother just took us around, and we were, well, I've got lucky enough to have lots of siblings, and we all just had the most wonderful time. And I think it virtually bankrupted them, gradually they put things back together.
How long did you stay there, living there?
I think a week, until it looked as though nuclear Armageddon had been postponed. And I do recall that they had chosen half term for the possibility of nuclear Armageddon, and so it wasn't too bad. Yes.
So you say that Gatwick Airport was a big feature in your childhood and your youth, I understand, as well.
We used to work there. Lots of people from Crawley just used to work at Gatwick Airport. So yeah. I cleaned out planes. I acted as a security guard, frisking people as a job, not a hobby. I cleaned out the offices of a company called BEA Air Tours, part of what is now British Airways. And I just the travel business is so unusual in that I think it is really compelling. So even if you're working at an airport, which is quite frustrating because there are all these people going off to wonderful places and you're cleaning out their planes for them, yeah. It's still so exciting. There's so much happening. There's such a sense of adventure, mostly involving other people. And those days, of course, I didn't think I'd ever be able to fly for fun, because it was just something that it was way, way beyond anybody's imaginings, who was just earning average amounts. And things have just got better.
Here you are today. Yeah. So when you were working there, did you kind of look up at the departures board and dream of far off lands?
No, because that would suggest that I was thinking of going there, and I couldn't.
Wasn't one that had a particular allure that you saw kind of flashing up?
Cleaning out Freddie Laker's planes when he was flying them to New York. But even at his fantastic fares, the idea that you would be able to just one of those things you never, I think probably I'm part of a generation who would never seriously think they could ever get across the Atlantic, and if they were lucky enough to get to Mallorca, then they would count themselves extremely lucky, which I still do.
So then how did you get from that to becoming the travel man?
I did have a sensible, proper job. I was a mathematician by training. Then I taught maths for a short while. Mm-hmm. Then I became an engineer for 15 long years. But all the time I was doing that, I was just doing writing guidebooks and trying to fund my travel habit.
Right.
And then this new newspaper started called The Independent. And they had a funny policy, which was they didn't take any free trips. And since nobody would give me a free trip, I was quite well suited to it. So I used to write stuff for them. And then Frank Barrett, the excellent original travel editor of The Independent, left to go to a better paying job. And they said, would you like his slightly less well paid job? And I said, thank you very much, after about one microsecond. And that was over 25 years now, beginning my 26th year. And my goodness me, every day I do wake up and think how lucky I am.
And you're known as then, as you were saying, you're known as the man who pays his way.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
A bit silly, frankly. Yes. So The Independent didn't take any free trips at all until about, I'm going to say 2003, when suddenly we expanded the coverage so much that there was simply no way of making the sums work unless we took trips from travel companies. Mm-hmm. But I just thought, hang on, I've been doing this for 9 years, and I can sort of just about do it, and that the cost of travel is falling constantly, so I'll just carry on doing this, and I can call myself the man who pays his way, and people can either think, well, how marvellous and noble, or just think, what an idiot. So that's all. It's just a point of difference, I guess. And you will never ever find me paying for a specific seat on a flight, or indeed for checking in a bag, thank you very much.
Never.
No.
So what's your tip for that then? What would you suggest people do?
Well, if with seating, okay, let's take the most extreme example, Ryanair, who seem to allocate quite a lot of middle seats early in the booking process. So you just check in 3 hours before the flight. And once I actually got seat 1A, best one on the plane, because they've got rid of all the rubbish seats.
Right.
And they've only got nice ones left to give you. And then even if you don't like the one you've been given, I'm afraid I'm always the last one on the plane. And I'll just get on and I'll scout, see, oh, there's a couple of empty seats there. I'll sit there and have a bit of extra elbow room. Or all the seat by the window in the second row, I'll have that one because then I can get off quick at the other end.
Yeah.
So...
very, very good tip. Oh. So moving on then to chapter two, that is the first place that you fell in love with.
Yep. Good question. Thank you. Good chapter. Going abroad, I would have to say Granada in Spain. So my parents, who were wonderful in their liberal view of children, had one thing, which was they wouldn't let us go to Spain until Franco had gone. And so the year after he went, I hitchhiked down to Spain and reached Granada and looked up at the Alhambra and just thought, this is the most magnificent thing I've ever seen. And I come from Crawley. This was just utter joy.
So is that a place that you still keep in your heart?
Yes. Yeah, so
go
I
back to
back
from time
with
to time.
My wife and younger daughter, and was still just utterly blissful. And anybody who's not been lucky enough to go there, I do recommend it. Very easy to get to. You can catch a bus straight from Malaga Airport if you can't afford the flight on BA from London City.
Right. Okay. So there are different options to go there. And if you go there, what would you recommend that people do?
Find a cheap and cheerful hotel. Go to, and this is a weird thing. There's so many weird things, Ollie, in travel, aren't there? Weird thing. You go to an ATM. You put your bank card in. It says, do you want a ticket for the Alhambra tomorrow? It does.
Oh, wow.
And you book a ticket for the Alhambra in a cash machine. It's just the weirdest thing. And then you go very first thing in the morning. Then you just enjoy walking through the... Oh, just such... I'm getting a real buzz just talking about it. Mm. Because you've got a combination of Islamic grandeur, this wonderful palace, and the kind of poorer quarters of the city where you do feel as though life has sort of slightly unraveled. And then back in the centre, you've got some grand buildings, you've got tapas bars everywhere. And it's just lovely.
Hitchhiking, I think, has featured quite heavily throughout the years in your travelling.
Yes, it's also, if I may, featured quite heavily in quite a lot of your podcasts.
I was going to say, yeah. Leveson Wood, a guest on season one, very big advocate of hitchhiking. And I'm really, I've never done it. I know. So,
well, let's go.
Yeah.
For goodness sake, it's...
Is it as easy today, would you say?
Easier. That's because I'm not 17 with long hair and a Belgian Army greatcoat, which costs £3.10, and just standing there with a roll-up in my mouth. So, yes, it is easier. Thank you very much. I think... just last summer I went to Skye, which is almost impossible to get to, even if you have got a car.
Yeah.
And I flew, I flew into Inverness. I was walking, and with any flight, particularly somewhere like that, you just get off the plane and you run because you know that the only people who are ever going to pick you up are the people on that plane.
Right.
So you run and you get out, and I got a lift to the complete middle of Scotland, the middle of nowhere, middle of the Highlands, and waited there about 2 minutes, and then this guy stopped and said, go to Skye, great, where are you going? And he said, I'm going to Glenbrittle, which is as far as you can possibly be in Skye and still be on the same planet. So that was great. And then coming back, I got another lift from Skye all the way down to Glasgow Airport. And this being the world that we're now living in, I was able to sort of think, right, okay, so we're in Glencoe now. It's going to take and actually book my flight as I was going along. It was fantastic. So it's just such a joy. You just meet people you wouldn't otherwise meet. And can I just put in a plug for how much safer travelling in general and hitchhiking in particular has become? far, far safer than when I started. And that's simply because the biggest threat to any traveller is road accidents. And certainly in the countries that people tend to go to, particularly Spain, Portugal, France and so on, the death toll on the roads bluntly has fallen so far that you're now far safer than you ever were. And anybody who says, oh, the world's more dangerous now, no, it isn't. I can show you lots of numbers and show you it's a lot safer. Thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that there's scaremongering and the media can put us off going to all kinds of places, and it really impacts on the tourism and the industry in these countries, and it's such a shame.
Well, there are risks, and I get a lot of people are kind enough to get in touch with me and ask me questions, and they will typically say, is Sri Lanka safe? Is Egypt safe? Is Turkey safe? And all I can say is no. There are risks attached to anywhere. I'd be particularly careful about road travel. There is a distant possibility of terrorism, but being, I guess, a mathematician and so therefore very, very keen on actual numbers, being a victim of a terrorism outrage, absolutely awful when they happen, but they are so rare. They're a bit like plane crashes. You might be caught up in one, but the chances are overwhelmingly that you won't be. And I don't say that with anything other than utter sympathy for anybody who's lost a loved one in a terrorist attack or a plane crash. But the world is just so much safer than it was.
Chapter 3 then, Simon, is the place where you learnt the most about yourself.
Oh, the philosophical ones. I'm going to keep this one fairly quick. So I think we probably find out about ourselves quite on a fairly continuous basis. So Isle of Wight Pop Festival 1970, I was 14 at the time, and there was this pop festival with 500,000 people, and my parents just said, yeah, off you go. And my sister said, yeah, come with us. Mm-hmm. It was fantastic. And so, being 14 and not really having anything to kind of calibrate things, you just thought, well, Jimi Hendrix was always going to be playing at a festival near you, that The Who were going to be there, that pretty much every group in the world, apart from the Beatles, who sadly split up, and the Rolling Stones, who I think were sulking, was there.
Wow, what a lineup.
You just learn that, yes, you can just... that you can make do with whatever you've got. And if you're in a crowd of 500,000 people, that would be all right. And I suppose the other one, which is kind of the other extreme where you're kind of a bit more alone, would be climbing Aconcagua, the highest mountain outside the Himalayas. And I would urge anybody who can put one foot in front of the other to try it, because, see, I'm scared of
where
heights.
Where is it?
It's in Argentina, very close to the border of Chile, and I'm going to say it's 23,000 feet minus a bit. I can't remember, frankly. It seemed a jolly long way, but you just plod all the way up to the top. And again, it takes a kind of 3-week trip from leaving the UK to getting back to the UK, if you've been lucky and you've been able to climb it. And you just need to be sort of lucky and keep going, really.
So tell me how that works. So where do you fly into, and then do you do training, and how long did it take you?
No. So I left Christmas Day. It was my 58th birthday, I do recall.
Yes, because of course you were born on Christmas Day.
Well, somebody has to be. 58th birthday, and I flew that night to Buenos Aires, went to and then transferred to Mendoza with a ludicrous amount of luggage, which I managed somehow not to pay any excess baggage on, even though I had something like, I think I was really stretching all the baggage rules. I had about 1.5 times my body weight in luggage. Then we just went to the base camp and we stayed there a couple of days, I think, to sort of acclimatise.
Yeah.
And then you just climb up and then climb back and climb up. And you're gradually taking stuff up the mountain and then coming back halfway. And it's...
Is it odd? I've never really climbed a mountain. Is it odd when you kind of go up that you then actually have to come back down again before then going further up?
For anybody who just likes a journey to be a kind of linear thing, it's completely mad. But you have to do it. And there's lots of very good medical type people all the way along who are checking whether or not you're up to this. And it's just kind of luck, if you genuinely luck and plodding away. So,
and what are the vistas like?
Oh, they're mostly terrible because it's just bare mountains. And so it's not like a wonderful Alpine or Pyrenean scene, particularly where you've got, you know, a beautiful little village tucked into the fold of a mountain. Nothing like it's bleakness.
Right.
And more climbers than you would have otherwise, because it's the highest point outside the Himalayas. So
so it's more of a challenge rather than a beautiful
Oh yeah.
Experience.
You wouldn't go there for the views.
Right.
You would go there because I think they say because it's there, you go there because it gives you a sense of achievement, particularly if you're scared of heights.
Yeah. And are you?
Oh, yeah. Petrified.
Yeah. Mm. So.
But there's very few things you can fall off. I've climbed Kinabalu in Southeast Asia, and you can most definitely fall off there really painfully.
Gosh.
But you can't really fall off Aconcagua.
Right.
Luckily.
Right.
And I didn't.
And so it was a memorable experience
for
you.
Well, yeah. And what I learned about myself was that I'm not a mountain man. I'm a cities person. Mm-hmm. Because the greatest thing, and I managed to come back down the mountain. They were heading back to Buenos Aires. I was going across to Santiago, which I'd not been to. And, immediately you have to have a vehicle to cross the border. I didn't have a vehicle and I had too much luggage and everything. And everyone was so nice and helped me, and got to Santiago and just went out and had a steak and a glass of red wine. I thought, oh, this is my comfort zone. And I just loved the noise and the bustle and the excitement and the restaurants and the airport and all the other things.
I've always wanted to go to Santiago.
It's gorgeous. There was a bit of trouble back end of last year, which is a shame, because it's most Latin American capital cities are quite ugly. Let's take out of that Buenos Aires is not in the center, but most of them are big and ugly and horrible. Santiago is just a joy, I find.
Really? So would you recommend that as a South American starting point if you hadn't been to the continent before?
I think I probably would. That's a very good question. Of course, it's the furthest South American capital from the UK, but makes perfectly good sense to go there and then come back. Yes.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom, and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb. So, chapter 4 then is my favourite chapter.
Okay, yeah.
And that is your all-time favourite destination.
Right. Well, I've done some homework on this. Mm-hmm. And I would say that it's a matter of timing. And so all-time destination, well, see, in 1989, and I don't know what it was special about that year, although I sort of began it in East Berlin at the time when, of course, nobody ever expected the wall to fall, let alone later that same year. I went to Albania. I took a group of football fans, or actually Albania fans, to the World Cup match, Albania against England, which England won 2-1 in Tirana. And then towards the end of the year, I went to Cuba for the first time. And in all of those places, and yes, I don't know if it's coincidental, they're all kind of weird communist places, being there in that moment was really special. But now, I mean, well, let's go through them. East Berlin is great, but it's kind of all part of Greater Berlin. Albania, I just find like the sort of Wild West, as opposed to the weird East.
What is Albania like? I'm really curious about Albania because I imagine it should have beautiful coastline.
Oh, it's got a beautiful coastline, lovely beaches, fantastic mountains. But just because it had a more extreme form of state communism than anywhere else in Europe, it does sort of feel slightly left behind.
And on to Cuba.
Yeah, Cuba. Well, Cuba in 1989 was peak Cuba in the sense that the Soviet Union still existed, and the Soviet Union was just pumping loads of cash into Cuba, which was handy for Cuba. It was, you know, as close as you could get to a workers' paradise in the Caribbean. You could get rum. The black market worked really well, so you would get cheap pesos and live like a king. It was a wonderful time to be a traveller there. Within 5 years, it became a painful time to be a traveller there, and a million times more painful for the poor Cubans because their money got cut off. And now, well, of course, Cuba is just great, and it has resisted Americanization, which is good, and it has kept its character. But, of course, like any boring person who's been to somewhere probably before many people, you say, oh, it's not like it used to be.
Yeah.
And it really isn't like it used to be, but it's still great.
But it has. Having said that, I'm surprised it hasn't changed even more.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I'm surprised too. It would have been very easy for it just to say, right, we're just going to do tourism. We look beautiful. But it hasn't. And that's a tribute, I think, to the people probably more than the government, who probably don't really know what's going on very much. And apologies, Cuban government, if you are listening, I would like to come back to your wonderful country and I promise I won't be rude about it.
So you are the go-to guy for travel tips. I wondered, what are your thoughts about the best places we could travel to by train? Because there are so many fantastic routes.
Well, you can do, but the train operators are making it as difficult as they possibly can for you to go by train. It is ridiculous. Look, you or I, you've got a smartphone there. You could, while we're talking, in 1 minute, book yourself a flight to Barcelona, okay? And you'd have a choice of dozens of departures during the day, and you could probably get one for 50 quid without even thinking about it.
Yeah.
If you were going to travel to Barcelona by train, you would need to sort out something with, well, let's say you bypass Eurostar and you go straight to Rail Europe, French Railways, and you book something. But it's going to cost you an awful lot of money, and it's going to be cumbersome. And then if your train is late getting to Paris, then they won't hold the connection for you. It's just going to be very messy. And that's one of the more extremely easy long distance journeys. You try getting to Rome by train. You spend longer planning the trip than it would take you actually to fly there. So the train operators really need to sort themselves out. While they haven't, the low-cost airlines will continue to rule.
Right. Okay. So we need to see a change being made there for the infrastructure.
I mean, it's been
to make it plain, easier for everyone.
It's been plain for 20 years that that's what they need to do. They've just chosen not to for their own internal reasons.
Interesting. So we've talked about your all-time favourite destination. I wondered then, what's your favourite city?
Favourite city? Well, London's pretty good from any account. I don't take to New York. I've spent quite a lot of time there, but it's just, I find it big and unfriendly and ugly, as opposed to other mammoth cities. I completely love Shanghai and Chicago. But New York I don't find particularly friendly. I expect Mumbai, where it's mad and ludicrously overcrowded and such fun, such nice people, so diverse, such a mix of people, fantastic food. Everything is really easy, even though you're in this overflowing city. So, yeah, Mumbai, probably. Thank you.
And do you have a favourite hotel?
I've got a few hotels that I have stayed in that are particularly memorable. First one is Esquinas Rainforest Lodge. And if you ever find yourself in southern Costa Rica, that's the place to go to, very close to the Panamanian border. I first went there on Christmas Day 1999 with my by then wife, Charlotte, and we stayed there, and that was wonderful. And I went back to film there about 5 years later. By that stage, we had a wonderful daughter called Daisy, who was, technically conceived there. So that was a delight.
What was it like? Tell me about the environment.
It is a proper eco hotel. I would hesitate before applying eco to anything, but it really is done on the soundest principle. So it is constructed using local materials with local workers. It's all founded, I think, by the good old Austrians who just sent a whole shed load of cash over. Properly sustainable buildings, all their water for the swimming pool comes from the rainforest. It is a fantastic driver of employment for people in the local village, and it just, you know, consumes all the stuff that that they grow locally and sell in the market. So,
and the wildlife?
There's lots of birds. I'm not very good at spotting birds. Look, I could look out of the window here and tell you if that's an Airbus A330 or a Boeing 787
really
going into Heathrow. But
those are the birds that you could spot.
I couldn't do a sparrow or an eagle. Well, maybe I could those two. But so I'm not a great bird spotter. But of course, just being in the wilds is wonderful.
So on that trip, did you stay just simply in that one hotel, or did you travel around?
No, we were going down the Pan-American Highway from Nuevo Laredo in the far north of Mexico, all the way down to kind of where the Pan American Highway dissolves in Panama City. It was great.
Oh, what a trip.
It was. Just hitching and buses and things. And in fact, that day we'd hitched there because the buses were all full because it was Christmas Day, my birthday. And I went off to get the bus tickets in the morning and I got mugged very badly there and I managed to run away.
And there we are. Your birthday and Christmas
Day.
Well, it
was fine, but everything turned good, thank you.
Mm. On that route, what were your highlights? I mean, it's such an incredible...
Yeah, I did like northern Mexico. It's got more and more dangerous. And then Mexico City, I adore almost as much as I adore Mumbai. And then Puebla, beautiful colonial place, and Oaxaca, just gorgeous. And then just going through Guatemala and Honduras and Nicaragua, but Panama, I think, is the funniest place in Central America.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, all good.
So chapter five, then, is your hidden gem. Can you tell me about a place? I mean, you're so well-travelled, you must have so many.
No, just a few. So I was really interested. You talked to Giles Brandreth, what a splendid fellow, mm-hmm. and he said he was born in Wuppertal in Germany, but he didn't say, and it's the home of the Schwebebahn, which is an upside down dangling tram. And that's wonderful.
Wow.
Yes. And so that's definitely a hidden gem, very close to Dusseldorf and Cologne. I love, like, again, quite a lot of people you've talked to, sort of former Soviet places, and the place you can find the closest you're ever going to get to what it was like in the Soviet Union is Tiraspol, which is the capital of Transnistria, which is the breakaway, unrecognized segment of Moldova that is off the map.
What's that like?
You have still got statues of Stalin, not to mention Lenin. You've got the sense of kind of public order, of everybody kind of watching everybody else, of nothing really being available very easily. It's so exciting and compelling, particularly for people who weren't lucky enough like me to be able to get to the old Soviet Union.
Is it quite brutal in terms of architecture?
Yes, it is actually. Yeah,
quite stark.
I'm trying to think if there's any charming bits, and no, charming bits were thin on the ground, but just fascinating. And then the Azores, which I don't know why so few people go to them. I've done 7 of the 9 so far. I'm keep hoping to go back to the remaining 2. They are just joyful, and each one is different.
The Azores are islands that are in the Atlantic.
So 1,000 miles off the coast of Portugal, Portuguese islands. Utterly charming, incredibly cheap for some reason. I don't really know why.
What would you compare them to? Because a lot of people haven't heard of them.
They're a bit like low rent, in every sense, Canaries, but kind of smaller and greener and more charming.
Right.
And actually, you just reminded me, I think probably the best single day's hitchhiking ever on the island of Santa Maria, where Concorde used to refuel. And I think I went three times in a row where the first car that came along stopped, which has never happened before. It's like the golf equivalent of getting 3 holes in one or something.
Mm-hmm.
So the Azores would be there, and Syracuse in Sicily. Not many people go there. Billions of people fly into Catania Airport,
yeah.
And they don't just go out, wait by the bus stop. In half an hour, a bus will be along. It will take you an hour. It will take you to this miraculous city so steeped in history. Just, of course, invaded by every civilization which swept across the Mediterranean. So lots of Greek, Roman history. Now it's slightly tottering Italian place. I mean, Sicily, I think, is kind of like a distilled, more intense version of Italy. So that's very good. There's just so many. And I suppose the other hidden gem, because I don't think people properly appreciate it, is Ryanair. It is just a great way to travel. And I think people need to find joy. End of last year, I was flying from Killarney in Ireland to Stansted, and I paid £18, I think, maybe less. And I got a window seat, obviously, because I just went for the best seat available when I got on. And you just get this fantastic map of the whole of the south of Ireland. And then you can see Cornwall coming into view, and then the whole of the Bristol Channel. And you're looking down and you've just got the whole... As somebody who constantly never thought they'd be on an aeroplane, apart from the once going to Guernsey, it's just so, so joyful. So yeah, a window seat on Ryanair, I would say, is one of life's little joys. Big joys, really.
That's a way of being grateful for even the kind of smaller things that people kind of moan about, right? So... we're on to chapter 6, that is the place that you'd never go back to.
Okay, fantastic. Oh, I'm so looking forward to this one. The terrible cruise that I dragged my poor, long-suffering family on to Arctic, Canada and Greenland. It began quite well with a Ryanair flight to Copenhagen and a night in the Hilton there, and then a beautiful flight across to the Kangerlussuaq. Your Greenlandic listeners must forgive my pronunciation. And we stayed in the youth hostel there, and that was all quite fun. And then things really got bad when we got on the Adventure Canada boat, which then delivered about one third of what we'd been expecting. It was true disappointment. The family were great about it. I just felt so awful.
So why was it so disappointing?
Well, because they said, we're going to go here and here and here and here and here. And also it all looked sounded great. And then they said, actually, we're not going to go there. And we're not going to do that. And yeah, we're going to let you go in the boats for an hour, but then we're going to bring you back to the ship. Oh, and then the crew are going to go out in boats and enjoy themselves for 2 hours. It was that staggeringly awful.
Oh my goodness.
Yes, it was. And I promised the family, look, put up with this, and we got first and only time going to put you in a 5-star hotel in Ottawa. And unfortunately, the flight was 13 hours late. So we got there about 5 o'clock in the morning, and they were still very nice about it. Even so.
So what would you say to somebody who is in that circumstance themselves as a traveller?
But all you can do is just say, there's no point getting rude or whatever. All you can do is say, look, I'm not sure that you're doing what you could be doing. And I talk to them all the way constantly in a nice way, I hope. And afterwards, when I was writing it up, I said, look, what about this and what about that? And they were effectively just saying, yeah, we think we did fine. And that's great. If that's what you think is doing fine, then that's good luck to you. But I will never, ever go anywhere near one of your ships again. Thank you.
Have you cruised since? Are you into cruising at all?
My family love going on cruises. I can sort of see the appeal, particularly in somewhere like the Caribbean, where actually getting to see half a dozen Caribbean islands is incredibly difficult if you were to do it yourself with putting together flights and ferries and so on. So a cruise is good. They love being on ships. I love escaping from ships. So it kind of works. And cruising's good value, because they're assuming you're going to order a bottle of the finest claret every night. And if you don't, then actually you can have quite a cheap trip. And the other great place to do it is Alaska, all the way from, well, Whittier, the port for Anchorage, all the way down to Vancouver. That's great too. And again, cheaper and better than other ways of covering the same ground.
And you see it from a different vantage point.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. So chapter 7 then, Simon, is your next big adventure. What do you have coming up this year that's on the horizon?
Well, I'm going to try and get to the Azores, which are just to do those two. And then the rest of it is sort of a matter of watching to see what happens. And I'm in the lucky position of being able to just think, right, something's happening here, I'm going to go and take a look. And if you're able to travel kind of off peak, you can do things at a moment's notice. And it's almost going back to the kind of serendipity and opportunism of hitchhiking, I would say.
And what would you say was your travel highlight from last year?
Oh, good question. Probably Scotland. Yeah, it's a wonderful destination.
Yeah.
And when the sun shines, I climbed some of the Coolins in the far end of Skye, and that was breathtaking.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I can't believe that we're already on to chapter 8, and that is what is at the top of your bucket list.
Well, okay, I would say Nepal. Never been there for various complicated reasons. We're trying to go with the family, but then the earthquake struck, very sadly. On the subject of mountains that I could probably climb without falling off, I'm very interested in Vinson in Antarctica, the highest mountain there. It's about the same height, I think, as Mont Blanc, but further away. And if I could possibly get it to tie in with the eclipse in December 2021, I think that would be quite special.
Oh, yeah, that absolutely would be. And how would you get there?
Well, you go to Ushuaia, southern end of Argentina, and you sort of do the maritime equivalent of hitchhiking, which is just sit there and wait for, just make it known that you're after some kind of passage to Antarctica and wait and see if there's a no-show on a boat, and you just get over there. So that would be one way to do it.
That is going to the farthest end of the planet. How exciting. Well, I hope that you get there.
Thank you. So do I. But you never know with travel, do you? Just make the most of everything you can.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for your time, Simon. Those were your travel diaries. It's been such a pleasure chatting to you.
Thank you. What an absolute treat.
Oh, that was Simon Calder. His enthusiasm for travel is just infectious, isn't it? You can follow his travels on his Twitter page at Simon Calder and tune into his podcast, which is on SoundCloud. It's called Escape Podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode today, then leaving a review or rating really helps other people to discover the podcast. Don't forget, you can listen on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Castbox, Stitcher, pretty much all other podcast apps. Wherever you leave a review, it really helps. And to find out who's on next week's show, come and find me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you again next week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom, and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.